Did you say jazz hole?
I'll become a full on jazz hole if I'm not like roped back in.
Oh, all right.
It's like all I fucking care about. It's like, you know, I don't know.
I see that, man. You're like,
I'm
good records, man. Like crazy, mad records, man.
Yeah.
You know?
I spend all, this is how I avoid my life. I avoid responsibilities and I just look at records on the internet and go out crate digging. It's yeah. stupid. It's like so impractical, right? Because everything's available online. Not everything, but it'll, you know. Anyway. Kick it off, homie.
Yeah, so
let's
this
go.
This is the part of the podcast where you act like it's a podcast and I pretend to introduce people. You pretend to be all nice and formal and you pretend that people think it's real.
It's like a meta podcast.
You've both been through this with me twice. So I have Michael Lee Nierenberg. What do you go by? I mean, do you prefer, what do people call you? Like Mike, Michael Lee Nierenberg? Like what?
I can't believe we never had this discussion.
You know,
20 something years. I everyone just calls me Mike.
I've always been Mike to me, right?
I professionally use my middle name because there was another Michael Nierenberg who was in that Bobby Fischer movie, and I used to always get his emails, which I used to fuck
he
with and
died.
Send emails back.
Yeah, he died recently, so you should be good.
And Marissa, we never gave your last name the last time. Are you out? Or doing something that you shouldn't be, or like we have to protect your identity. Are you in like the witness protection program or anything like that? Or we could just like out you as Marissa Baldessaro.
You could go with Baldessaro. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter because honestly, nobody knows how to spell my last name and they always spell it wrong.
Well, she's
so
Nerd Spring Break on Twitter.
Yes, Nerd Spring
Follow
Break.
Follow Marissa. She's
but,
a total.
Yeah.
Do you edit?
The trip.
Do you edit these, Mike?
I do, yeah, if I need to.
Can I go pee?
Absolutely, man. Go to the bathroom, though. Don't do it here. Use it. Do the bathroom.
Go pee in your plants.
Yes.
What's up?
I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to put this on the podcast.
Who cares, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's life.
I could edit this part.
Yeah. So.
Not even 5 minutes in, and he's got me editing already. So he's got to take a shit.
He's, you know, high maintenance. You know, these New Yorkers. These
I know.
New
you, Yorkers had, you had to tone it down. You had to when you came back. You had to tone it down a little bit, man. But you were high maintenance for a while. You were at James Street, high maintenance, West Village.
I was
Hudson Street. Starting to be like the 70s again.
There's
graffiti. I think there's going to be more graffiti in the city in 5 years than there was in the entire 1970s.
Crazy. When was the last time you went into the city?
Was it last summer? It's been
Thanks,
over
Dick.
A year since I've been in the city.
Yeah.
Let's give a
it's
pause
crazy.
To edit me back in.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah, that's the pause. So I don't remember what we were talking about before the break.
Mike was talking about jazz.
Oh yeah, and we were saying follow you on Twitter.
No one wants to talk about that. I'm surprised it never happened for you, Marissa, because what happens is like hip hop heads go for the samples, right? And then they find themselves listening to the samples. And then punks end up at the end of punk, right? Which is like the spikiest Albert Eiler, like just heaviest, most noisiest jazz, right? And then everyone sort of coalesces around jazz in the end because like it's like the end of rock. It's at the end of hip hop. It's at the end of all these countercultures, right? End of all these like genres of music, right? I also like don't think any. It's kind of like the Dead, right? I kind of get why people don't like them,
right?
But now, at the same time, I'm surprised it never happened for you.
You know, in high school, I had a few jazz records. I had a couple Miles albums. Coltrane. You know, you're 101 now. Stuff. I am different. And you know what? I probably, after reading that Art Pepper autobiography,
oh my God,
kind of got me interested in it.
It's the best rock bio there is.
Amazing.
It's the 10
stars.
The one common link of like rock fans. I'm sorry. It's like Coltrane and Miles. Like we all start with Coltrane and Miles.
Right.
But you don't necessarily have to. You don't have to. I think I could probably make a list. I could make a playlist of stuff that bridges the gap that I think like someone who isn't accustomed could like be walked right in.
Yeah.
Because I get it. It doesn't make sense. It's like, I don't know. It's very complicated. My relationship with it.
Do you think it's because the musicians that we grew up liking and listening to were into Coltrane themselves and Miles, and they just have that association, like there's that thing that, you know, like Miles was playing with rock musicians by the 70s, and he was supposed to have made a record with Jimi Hendrix had Jimmy lived, and you know,
Coltrane, with Paul McCartney. I
mean, Jerry Garcia Band was playing Coltrane. What am I saying?
Well, he played prime time with Ornette Coleman. Well, I mean, Jerry played on Ornette Coleman's primetime record.
Right, but, right.
Well, I mean, like,
I
have some thoughts about it. Like, my dad sent me this podcast, right, where it was about the Birds, 8 Miles High, and it was about like how they were all like getting into Coltrane's Ascension and Ravi Shankar and all this music, right? And then all the parts, like, it's like this beautiful pop song, but it's also noisy as hell. And it's because they were like getting into all this, like really like, it was like jangle pop. But what was so beautiful about it is it pushes the edges of it. It's like also incredibly like difficult in the middle. And it was because they had just got into Coltrane's Ascension, which was like when he was abandoning like, you know, trad jazz and getting into like, you know, free jazz. And it's wonderful, you know, it's like, it frees you up in your mind. It's like taking acid.
I'm ready. You know, Mike and I have discussed this, like starter albums, because it is one genre that I don't know much about. You know,
podcast listeners will get a playlist of me walking
you in. Very good idea. Because I trust your opinion, Mike. It's such a broad, it's like, where do I start? You know?
But sometimes you hear something where you're like, oh, well, this, how could anyone not like this? It's so beautiful.
Right.
And this happens a fair amount. I mean, like, okay, Mike.
Mike and I have been talking about jazz for close to 10 years, but for the first 8, when I would see Mike in the city, when we would meet for dinner, I would say, I'm still very jazz 101. I'm still very jazz 101.
Right.
That rock fan approach to jazz where, you know, you go after the basic starter, like your Zeppelin IVs and Ziggy Stardusts and Who's Next and the basic rock albums. There's the basic jazz record, right? I'm not saying everybody, but it's kind of like where Bob Marley is like the go-to reggae artist. He's like the one reggae artist that most rock fans,
which is so crazy to me.
Right.
Because so, I can make a list of beautiful songs that like would rope in.
Right, of course. So it's like, you know, for years it was always like, well, the basic Miles records and the basic Coltrane, just like this, you know, like the starter kit. And then you got to go out and you have to get Take Five, you know, Time Out, and, you know, Dave Brubeck and Charles Mingus, and just the basic core 10 jazz records that most people start with, right? And then I
thought sometimes they're not a record. But they're also not a good fit sometimes. Like sometimes like those starter records are not a good fit for someone who's into rock. It's like the institution tells you that, but actually over here, there's like, say like a really like punky sort of like crossover record that's maybe even better, you know, like something like the Horace Tapscott or something that's like really like, that has like rock guitars throughout, or Sonny Chirac.
Exactly.
Sonny Chirac sounds like Black Flag. There's like no one else who sounds like that.
Right. Because most people don't know about that. It's because they started on those records. Those other records didn't fly. You know, it didn't really gel with them. And then they just get this bad taste of jazz. So that's it. That's a bad taste in my mouth.
Right.
I wasn't crazy about it.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. Because I think that's kind of what happened to me. maybe I bought, I think I may have had like, what's that one, Miles? I think I still have it on the corner. I had that one.
Oh my God. It's fucking awesome. It's like an assault. It's like a Funk assault.
And it's also maturing. You know, I think getting older, it's kind of like the dead. It's like something, the older I get, I mean, the more I appreciate it. As I get older too, I appreciate kind of background music. Stuff that I can kind of just put on.
That's how it started. Like for me, it was like, I needed something to read and write to. And then it clicked.
I feel like I felt in my early 20s, like my late teens and early 20s, when there was all of the art was ahead of me, all of the artists to dig.
And your mind's blown open by all the different stuff. Yeah.
For the first time in like 30 years, I felt jazz did that.
It's not to say that there aren't like wonderful hip hop records being made today and wonderful rock records, because there are. Every day I'm still like listening broadly. It's not just like, you know, there are wonderful hip hop records coming out today that are just like mind bending. And I really like have to sift through a ton of bullshit to get there. But there's sources online where you can like find people who know, who are sifting through all of it, who, you know, understand what the real thing is when they
even
see
tribe
it. You know,
sample Coltrane.
Oh, sure. I mean, like they were the first to
As far as like samples and hip hop go, I have gotten into a lot of stuff from samples. But yeah, like Tribe heavily sampled.
It's the most amazing thing when you're out somewhere and you hear the original of a sample and it clicks in your brain.
Yes.
And you're like, oh my God. I was in a restaurant. I heard this song. I don't remember what the song was, but it's this comp of Ethiopian jazz. And it was the Jay-Z sample that Kanye used, who I don't really care about.
Oh, really?
And I was like, oh my God. It just like clicks into place. You just are like so invigorated by like hearing that familiar piece inside its original context. It's just like, and then you like Shazam it before it goes away real quick because you know what it was. Or you can like Google what the sample is of the song that you can hear in your head.
Well, that's the cool thing now is that, well, I don't know if you can Shazam it, but you know, there's more back when we were young before the internet was a thing, you heard a sample, but you really didn't have a source for it. But yes, like I remember getting into like a lot of the Stax stuff. Because Wu-Tang, I believe, sampled a lot of that.
Yeah, a lot of the Isaac Hayes, Hot Buttered Soul.
Yeah, so when I was like in my early 20s, that was like, whoa, mind-blowing, very exciting.
I will Shazam, if I hear like a dance hall reggae jam that sounds like noisy and like fucking mean coming out of someone's car, I will Shazam that shit. When you live in the city, you can like, you're at a red light, you're like, what the fuck is that? That's fucking great. Or like, that's fucking horrible. And Shazam, and I love that. You know, it's the most amazing invention. Like when I first saw it, I was like 2010 or 11. I saw someone Shazam something. I was like, oh my God, it's like a magic power. It still amazes me because I come from the pre-internet era.
Right.
I've heard about Shazam, but I've never used it.
What?
No, believe it or not.
It comes in handy when you're like in a. And I do my late night, you know, drugstore runs to like Walgreens. And,
I saw the Wu-Tang tour bus once. I was sitting in the Betty Lynn Diner in Elizabeth, New Jersey, man, and the Wu-Tang tour bus pulled up at a red light.
There was some jazz playing in a restaurant, and I was like, this is, I don't remember what it was, but I called it. My dad's like, bullshit. You're full of shit. That's not what it is. And I Shazammed it, and I was right.
It was.
Yeah, another time at work, I heard someone listening to something, and it was like, and I was like, oh, that's Paul Chambers and Bill Evans playing for Miles Davis. And they were like, no, it's not. And I was like, fuck you, it is. And I Shazammed it. I was like, shut the fuck up.
Were you right?
Yeah, now no one steps to me. I could like name a fucking song like that. It's like, I wish I could monetize this. Yeah. I wish I could monetize this thing I could do. Because I can't. it's like Total Recall for jams and like no recall for anything else. My memory is fucking garbage. Except jams.
My memory is good for everything before like 1986. And then
you have a photographic
Very, but the funny thing is what's weird about it is it's like the 70s and the 80s. I can't remember last week. I can't even remember like anything from like the last, like I can't tell you 2017 from 2013 from 2003. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just like the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah. For as many drugs as I've done, I have a pretty good memory. The only problem is with my memory. Oh my God,
Marissa remembers all the horrible things everyone has ever done, myself included. Especially
I do. I remember a lot of very small, detailed kind of stuff, but my memory never serves me when I actually need it. You know, it's always, or even when, you know, it's really frustrating when people ask me like about music or to name some things that books or whatever, and I just go fucking blank. And it drives me.
Oh my God. That's the worst question. Oh, at work, yeah. People know that I know this stuff. And they ask me all the time, like, what are you listening to? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, every day.
It's so frustrating.
I don't even know how to deal with the question in a way. It's like, I have to like start like thinking back to like, what did I do today, yesterday?
Yeah.
My son, like every time I'm like, I hear a song, and like my favorite song in the moment, I was like putting on Killing Joke for Ollie before, and I was like, oh my God, this is my favorite song, Exit by Killing Joke. And he's like, that's not your favorite song. I thought Parliament did your favorite song. I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's true too. It's all true.
Right. Right. There's so many favorite songs. It sucks because that's the other issue that I'm going through now is it's really hard for me to listen to music because I have little kids. So the time that I do have is usually, unfortunately, staring at my phone and zoning out. But I think it's getting better now. But that was another reason why jazz is a little bit more appealing to me, because I can put it on. And if my kids are around, it's not going to be distracting. You know, whenever there's songs on with singing or lyrics, they drive me fucking crazy.
It drives me nuts when I'm writing. I can't listen to singing when I'm writing. Right. That's where I really like dove headfirst into jazz, because I was writing and I was writing every day, right. and that was the backdrop for right. either that same. Or classical.
Yeah, same. Like I used to. I like mostly listening to hip hop. On average, as far as contemporary music goes, I like it more than rock music. And like, I found that like I couldn't like access the thing. I couldn't do the things I needed to do because I would get so taken with the lyrics.
I don't know how you, where the last time we talked about this, you were like, oh man, I write the crazy stuff, man. All that crazy,
the real poem. Spiky stuff.
Yeah, or anything. But
I don't
can you do
really write vocals? Though. I copy and paste my interviews into like a story. Like I'm not like a real writer. I'm
okay,
like a hack.
All right.
It's fucking like I just edit, really, is what I do. And I just could listen to the wildest shit and doesn't like change. Like rarely does am I like no, not right. But then you know I've been reading Franz Fanon's anti-colonial texts on the subway, and I'm like I can't listen to anything. And
right. Right, like, reading, you know, is.
I usually have like one, you know, one really difficult book that requires my full attention, and then I just listen to white noise.
Like I wish I could read a book, man. There's something as simple as reading a book, you know. That's where I'm missing. That's what I'm really missing these days, is because it all my work is requiring fucking research, and I'm always right. reading, man. But it's just not. I'm not reading for enjoyment anymore. Now it's just going toward crafting a story out of these little.
You have to read for enjoyment. You have to make the space.
Well, yeah,
it's a requirement for.
But
for
do
like
you find
a,
that?
A person.
Do you find when you write that when you do read it influences your writing?
No.
No, because no. I usually read. If I read, it's usually nonfiction. And if I'm reading somebody like, all right, I'll give you a perfect example. I'm always reading history or art history or something nonfiction, something history related, which in no way affects my work, except with, like somebody like John Richardson, who wrote the 3 or 4 volumes of Picasso. And I always said, well, this is the type of a, if I ever did a story or biography or multiple biographies, I would want it to be this fucking detailed.
Right. So he's like Anthony Caro.
Right.
He's just like Anthony Caro.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He's the guy that did like the Power Broker.
Or Robert Carroll. It's a Robert Carroll or Anthony Carroll. One of them's a sculptor. Robert. So
Power Broker in the LBJ books.
Did you ever read the book he did called Working that he put out a couple years ago? It was about his work methods. Send me your address. I'll mail it to you tomorrow. I have a copy of it.
Okay. So, and the other thing would be like, if I read something like Tom Wolfe or anybody that does the same type of thing that I try to do, which is basically literary nonfiction, I start to get self-conscious and I start to think like, I try to, oh, there's something wrong with this, or I should write it. This needs to be more interesting. Tom Wolfe just fucking leaps off the page. And this is just, you know, I start to get self-conscious if I read other writers who, it's a weird thing. So, you know,
kind of well, understandable. It's understandable. Right. Those are masters. Those are masters of the masters of the game. Like when I read oral history, I think, fuck you, I could do this.
Right.
Like I read like Gene Stein. I'm like, you're the master. I reread Gene Stein to get to what I want it to be.
Did you read Eden?
I read all of her books at least
twice. Oh my God, that one was so fucking good.
And I don't reread books. She's the greatest to ever do it. And that's who like McNeil tried to emulate, you know? So like,
right.
She's the greatest. I actually would love to like ask someone like Legs McNeil, like, because I have these practical questions, because I don't know anyone who's done what I've done or what I'm doing and what I did in the last book. So I need to like, I would love to ask someone who's actually done it, because I've never done that. I've just had to invent it for myself. And I have my own way of working, which heavily involves a computer. But how'd they do it before computers? I can't even fucking imagine it.
When he wrote that book,
it's amazing.
He did, when he put it together, like what
and the method, porno book
what
too.
Was he using before there were computers and all that?
Yeah, I would love to ask the practical questions.
They probably just recorded everybody and then transcribed the best parts.
You both used to interview a lot of people, and you're both used to working with tape recorders and transcribing.
Right.
Right.
That's right. Because I used to always use my tape recorder, because this is before computers, really. I mean, there was computers, but there wasn't really anything that supported tape recording somebody, you know.
Was there
it wasn't that
other,
advanced yet.
Like, was there any
it's
other
the transcribing
way that you
it's the, well, I what I've figured out is like, if you use one of those services, one of those transcription services, are also terrible. It's not even worth it. It's like, yeah. The money you save is the money you'll spend trying to like transcribe it. So now I have a lady in Jamaica I met on Fiverr who transcribes all my stuff, and I've been using her since the last book, and she transcribes, and then I edit. I spend when I'm at work, I will pre-edit the audio files to edit myself out. So, and then I get then I send them out to her. And I'm only backed up to about a dozen or so that she hasn't got to yet. And then as she sends them back, I put them into the main text. And right. I have this software called Scrivener, where you can like, Scrivener changed my life. Like I was using a Google Doc before that, and then you can never find anything. You gotta go up and down, up and down. But like this, you can chunk out your chapters on the left-hand column. So you can just like dip in and out of them as you need them. That shit changed everything. My manuscript right now is like 500,000 words, unfortunately.
Oh my God. Writing is
overwhelming.
So fucking, it's see, that's fucking why I didn't mind doing interviews, because, you know, it was just transcribing, but I'm working on this fucking zine and it's like killing me. It's so hard to write. I don't know how you fucking do it all the time.
I hate transcribing. I hate it.
I won't
I
do it.
More than editing.
That's why I make as much money as I humanly can, so I don't have to fucking do shit like that. Like I need to like, you know, I hire out because I need to just get the text back. And they're usually very good. Right. I found someone. And she also knows my preferences. You know, like I have preferences that I use. Amanda Fortini on Twitter set me up with a transcriptionist, but I haven't used her yet. Like,
did she? She's super nice. I like her. Amanda.
Yeah, like she set me up with someone, but I haven't used them yet because I'm like very loyal to the person I'm using.
And you found her where? Fiverr?
On Fiverr, that website where you just hire someone from.
I was doing transcription work for Rev for like 3 days, and it was just like such a pain in the ass, man, just to make 12 cents. You know, it's like they
murder.
Pay you nothing, man. So I was just kind of like,
I always check in and like, you know, I'm like, send me a quote, make sure the money's good, make sure it's worth your time.
Yeah.
I don't want to exploit anybody. I just want to make sure that, like, you know, she feels like she's getting what she wants. And I could do it. Fortunately, I'm in a place where I could do it. I also shot a documentary that I shot all the footage for a documentary that I'm going to, after the book is done, I shot all the footage for a documentary I'm going to do after the book is done. I shot all the raw footage for it, and it's fucking awesome. But I can't even go near it till this book is done because it's so big. I've interviewed like 100 or over 100 retired movie veterans, and they're telling you about all the stories about like movies like The Exorcist and all the stuff that no one's ever like. Anyway, I don't want to talk endlessly about this. I mean, just like it's triggering.
Have you gotten to a point? I will ask you this though, because I'm.
Yeah, I mean, you can ask me anything. I just don't want to monopolize this.
Because just to see if it mirrors where I'm at. Are you at a point yet, and I know you are, where you're in the middle of it, man, and you're maybe three quarters through it or whatever it is.
Up to my waist.
You're surrounded by the pieces, and you're like, fuck. Like,
yeah.
Like, there's no turning back now, man. There's
when you interview over 100 people and you're still like churning out audio, right? And you have like hundreds, thousands of pages of transcript that you're trying to turn to a book, right? It's so big and overwhelming that at some point I'm like, by Christmas, I want to have the rough draft to show to, you know, the sample chapter to say like, all right, now I'm ready. Because you're so in it that you can't see like what is good and what's terrible and what's only interesting to me because I'm in the business. They only talk to me because I'm in the business. They only like tell me the shit because they trust me because I'm not gonna like sell them out.
There's a couple areas where both our books kind of cross paths too, man, because of the nature of the film industry, and you're interviewing a lot of people on the set from films that were shot in New York and in and around New York City, right? And because my book deals heavily with Saturday Night Fever, man, I have a feeling we probably.
I have a chapter. I'll show it. It's not done.
The same people. That's that. Well, after it's all said and done.
After the podcast, we should compare notes on that because I have a Saturday Night Fever chapter, and it'll probably make the book. Only because like. I have like a lot of inside information on how it was shot. Like I'm too deep in it to like really like have any perspective on it, but I know what I got is fucking amazing. It's I feel like it's the best thing I've ever done because it's so fucking, it fluctuates between like being insanely like wild and crazy to being like, oh wow, that's interesting. I didn't know they could do things that way. Or, you know, it's like when you have the people who made the best films of all time in front of you and you could just ask them how they did it. And then they tell you like a dick joke. It's the greatest. You realize that we're all just winging it.
Right.
And they were winging it too. Did I tell you about my car security plan? The way I keep my car safe from breaking into?
No.
Oh, go ahead.
So
the club.
Jesse found a bunch. No, this is better. It works on guilt. So Jesse found a stack of CDs outside. Put this in the podcast. This is really good.
It works on guilt.
Jesse found, my wife found a stack of CDs outside, and one of them was a burned CDR of Whitney Houston's Christmas. And what I do is like, I have trash all over the car, right? And then like I put Whitney Houston's burned CDR on the passenger side with a like a sad looking K95 mask, right? And that's like, I feel like it's so sad if someone's listening to Christmas jams in like July and August that like, they're like, oh my God, what is it? This is my Nana's car. I can't break it. It's like, it looks like someone's sad Nana. So like, that's my security plan. And so far so good.
But
there's also like about, I tweeted about this. There's also like about, you know, yeah, it's so funny, right? With the trash everywhere. I got trash all over. It's like fucking...
Well, they know that there's nothing valuable in a car that someone's still listening to Whitney Houston CDs.
Exactly. And then like, someone's like, oh, I can't do
this. I'm wasting my time on this car. Sad car.
Bendito.
Bendito. Oh my God.
What do you want to talk about, Stick Man? Hit me up. I'm loose.
I didn't even expect to talk about music today. I didn't even know what.
Really? Like, I thought that's what the show was.
My favorite shows are the ones where we don't talk about music. And that's just by chance because, you know, it is a music podcast. But I honestly really didn't think too much about it. I just knew it was going to be good. From the moment I met both of you, man, it's always like this, the kitchen jams.
Kitchens, yeah.
A lot of life, you know? A lot of life. I was saying to someone recently like that, like in my house, I like to have like a lot of life going on. Like I have a lot of plants, a lot of music playing, kids running around, life. No fucking, you're making fun of me, Marissa, but I don't care. It's true.
I hear you.
I want to have life, love. You know, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, you need good energy. It's all, you know,
well, there energy is, of a... Like Stickman, like my, you know, our friend Stickman, or my ex co-host Stick Nixon, right? So since we were babies, you know, we had that unspoken connection of sharing the same exact sense of humor, right? Now, like on the surface, man, that's very common. That sounds very common and is very general. And like, you know, anybody can have that same thing with a lifelong closest friend. You know, it's like that thing where we have that same warped sense of humor as if we like share the same brain, right? You get that? Right? That warped sense of humor. Like, and it's like one brain controlling both of us. So when I met you two, I saw the same thing going
day
on,
them.
Right? That this warped sense of humor, but it was a different kind of warped. It was like your own warped. And
yeah, I got no lines with humor.
Well, do you think that has to do with geography?
To a certain extent.
Right.
You know, because
nature versus nurture.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a little of both.
Yeah, I mean, you know, environmental. It's always like how, you know, when I lived in New York and I would meet somebody from around where we're from in Jersey and like the instant comfort of that, you know.
There was this Nuremberg Baltasaro brand of warped humor.
That but you can't connect.
The same but different than the same. You know, it was kind of like why we all connected, I think.
It's not completely nurture in that, like, you couldn't just connect and do zingers with anyone from around the way.
That's
like,
true.
It has to
That's
be like
true.
It has to be nature plus nurture. It's like it's a little bit of both. I think in this case, it's very specific. Like, I met Jay when we were like 12 and we were fucking, when I turned around him, I turned to like, we're like Beavis and Butthead, but like dumber, you know, me and my son watched all the Beavis and Butthead. And like, it's the same with his generation. It's a beautiful thing.
Let me ask you this then, where you are in your, the book that you're working on. Let me see if I could phrase this question or ask this question properly, because I know what I want to say. So let me just arrive at saying or how to say it. Where you are today, where your creativity, like this incarnation of Mike Nirenberg, not so much as you as a person, but more as in terms of your artistic vision. How far removed from the guy who made the Roach Detectives and customer service is the guy that's writing this book? In other words, are any of those aesthetics from 20 years ago applied to the work you do today or how you do it?
I think very much so. I saw this documentary about William Friedkin, and like there was like a scene where like he's talking about how like a car pulled up in a scene and you could see the reflection of the film crew in the side of the car, and he's like, and people were like, but he's like, fuck it, I only do one take. And I love that. And I was like, and he said like, people know it's a fucking movie if they see the movie crew, so fucking what? And I love that. I feel like that totally connects me to like everything I've ever done. Like I've said, I hate everything I've ever done, yet I feel like the same per fundamentally. And another thing I think of, there's this German artist, I saw a PS1 called Christian Schliegensief. And in early in his career, he made like slasher films, and he made movies about Hitler and all this stuff. And then at the end of his career, before he died in his 40s, from like some disease. He was like a total like activist, right? Like he didn't make those movies. He just was like an activist, and it all makes sense. I'd like to think when I'm gone, it'll all make sense, but I don't even care.
So you will be everything you've done?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't want anyone to ever see anything I've ever done. I want to like come in new.
You can't watch it or like, or do you cringe? Bother with it?
I would never. Yeah. It's totally massive insecurity. It's like not about anything other than that. Yet I blindly, with a ridiculous amount of ego, I go into everything I ever do like I know what I'm doing. Even the way I operate at work, it's like, of course I know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing, but of course I know what I'm doing because it'll be great. And I run my whole life that way. Parenting, cooking, it's all the same to me. Just wing it. I don't know.
I mean, a lot of your early stuff,
it's all bullshit, right?
You were kind of like learning as you were going, but you already had a sense of this is what it's going to look like. This is what it's going to, you know, I'm thinking in particular of, remember when you were making a movie that never got released, man, that I gave you a lot of hell about, you know, called Map Man. And you had a still from Map Man that I was totally in love with, man. And you gave it to me as a print of it because I thought it was so
really?
Profound,
I'd love to see it, man. Sometime.
It was the Map Man walking in circles with his briefcase, man. He was like, it was almost like a circular motion. It was the Map Man. Was like,
that's
like
wonderful. I'd love to see it sometime.
That's what looks like a cartoon, right?
Yeah, but there were other
things. Like a New Yorker
like a painting
cartoon.
Customer service, man. Customer service. At the end of customer service. That. Dead Marissa with the bullet in her head. You know? I had that hanging on my wall. You know?
You know what's funny? I think about this sometimes because, you know, I work on this TV show. And last week I had in the morning, I had to like, I had the director of this TV show I work on. It's like, okay. I had to bloody up a bathroom where the character got shot, right? And like the character got shot and like in the shower and I had to bloody up the bathroom. And I know how to do it because it looks great. And he's like, wow, you really, this is really impressive. And I was like, I'm a sick person. And then later that same day, another person got shot in a restaurant at a location. I did two like bloodbath scenes in one day. And that's not that different from what I was doing on my own movies. Like I always loved gore and like, yeah. And it's almost not that different from like the activism, right, that interests me, like the
size of
the environmental activism. It's like, yeah, these are like pretend horrors and then real horrors are real horrific. It's like you grow up, you know, and you know, you join a union, you get this rate and like you could perform. But it's really not that different because I'm just spattering blood on shit. And I walk out of the room like a fucking artist.
Yeah. I still say there's a lot of value in those early films because on one level, you can look at it as saying, okay, this is Nirenberg in his early years when he was like developing and he working on a very small budget and we worked very local and
no budget.
But again, man, there was a sense of vision and a sense of, I dare say, like if there's the word auteur, you know, the word auteur, you know, like
I wouldn't be surprised
where you had a brand, man. You had a look about it. You had the people. You know, you knew you were going to see Marissa. You knew you were going to see, you know, to an extent, you know, Stephanie was in quite a few of them. I don't know, like you know, it was like you see a lot.
She was fantastic.
People, you know, much the
she
same
was great.
Way that Woody Allen works with the same people in the early days.
Right, and that's who, that's why
we were
I was
watching a lot of Fassbender too. I think at those
yeah,
that
we
time,
wanted to.
You know,
Marissa, if you remember, we wanted to be like Fassbender and John Waters. Yeah. Like that's who we. And right. We were watching a lot of Spider-Man. We wanted to be those guys, and we thought we could. And I wouldn't be surprised that it's at some point in the future if those movies that I made are appreciated by younger people who want to go out and make their own thing. I think that would be like the most beautiful, most wonderful thing that could happen to them because like I personally like yeah, I did them and I don't like look at them or care about them or think about them, but like if someone did and they cared about them and it made them like feel like they could do their own, that's a beautiful thing, and I would totally support that and help them any way I could.
Right. I rewatched Customer Service and maybe Pagans. I don't know, not that long.
Oh my god, unwatchable. But the one about Aunt Phyllis is great. The one about
that's great.
Like the, I was but thinking
Pagans
recently
had its
how
moments.
I want to make sure. But the documentary I just shot.
Moments.
My nephew loves the one with the raccoons.
Yeah, it's great.
He puts that on. He knows how to get to it now.
Yeah, it's great because I did it at lunch. I was working on this TV show, a hospital show, and this like stuffed raccoon showed up in the scenic shop. So I was like, let's put this on fishing line and let it attack everyone on the crew, and we'll shoot it at lunch and on like a little, you know, mini DV cam. I love that. It shouldn't, don't over fucking think it. Not everything has to be a fucking Raga.
Well, I have to say,
you just drag the raccoon, you know, you don't even try to like, you know what I mean? It's just like,
even though my whole day job is about doing realism for television shows, it's a great irony, right? It's like the shit, like it didn't matter, right? But then at the same time, like when I go to work every day and get paid this money to hide the strings, you know, what were you saying, Marissa?
No, I was saying that I going on Twitter and on, you know, any social media and seeing a lot of these young kids in New York who are artists, and I feel like they're starting out the same way. A lot of them are doing horror-based stuff for, you know, it's kind of like the natural, when you're young, the kind of the natural progression with a lot of these artists. And it's just funny to see them doing stuff that we did very young, you know, lo-fi, low-budget kind of movies or photo shoots, a lot of horror stuff, a lot of special effects, cheesy special effects.
Do you remember how hard it was to actually get a camera at times? Like, there was times where, like, we just didn't have a camera. We probably would have shot a whole lot more if we had camera and tape, but, like, we didn't. Like, that's the thing. It's like, everyone has a camera, and it's wonderful. Everyone should, you know, I think the kids, like, it's fantastic, and I think we're going to see, like, great things coming from young people because, like, raw, and they also, because of the way the economy is now, they also know that there's no money to be made, so fuck it. Go all the way.
We remember just when it
fucking
took. When,
push it. We took a ton of speed.
Yeah, we did take, that was, a lot of it was speed-based, but remember how long it took you for to upload, I believe, what was it, Pagans or one of the movies? It was days, remember?
Like, it took days, right? And I was telling my son this the other day, my son who's 11, I said to him, I was like, the first time I ever saw like a video internet message was like Bob Kowal, a friend from high school, sent my dad, to my dad's email address, he sent a video and it took 2 days to fucking download. And when it came in, it's like, hey man, it's Bob calling from the internet. And that was the whole video. And we waited 2 days for this. In fact, Bob would come over during the 2 days and see how the download is going. That's the sort of primitiveness. And so we didn't like work with the internet. There was like no like when we made those movies, there was like, I mean, later on we put them on YouTube, but no one cared. So I took them off. I was like, I'm going to create scarcity by taking them off YouTube.
Yeah. That we had no funds. You know, there was really no money in it, and it was primitive, but it's the same thing that makes, you know, the early John Waters movies so great, is the primitive,
right? I could never and we could never be that again in our lives. I'd love to think that we will make another movie like that again sometime, like, but I think our kids will have to like be in them, and like I think it's I bought this house upstate on 33 acres, and I think that's where we're gonna make movies. You know?
Yeah, you have, that's the best kind of backdrop too.
Like for 34 acres, we with no neighbors, you can do whatever the fuck you want, no matter how wild.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's these young kids do have I feel like an old person now, but you know they do have a lot more edit. They can edit stuff easily. You know,
it's wonderful. If I could help them in any way, I will. Like if you know. I think it's fantastic.
Well,
you know, I know a lot of people in my position would probably be very bitter, but like, I think that's bullshit. Like, I'm very happy with the way my life went, you know?
Right. I mean, never again will I ingest that much speed or other illegal drugs.
Marissa, I still say you have a few books in you.
Me?
Yeah.
You have a few books in you.
You shouldn't be giving it away for free on Twitter. You should be writing books.
I know.
Well, the great thing is the short memory. The short memory on Twitter doesn't matter. Like, you could just say some shit and then put it in the book. I have all this research and I'm using.
I find it so hard to write about myself. For me, it's easier to write about other people. Like,
talk shit.
Right. Well, no, it's the Dori Previn zine I'm working on is easy for me because, you know, it's about somebody else. But the person who's editing it for me said, you know, you got to make this a little bit more personal because that's where your strength
that's
is.
That's the hook.
You're funny. Yeah, that's exactly. The hook. You have to, insert yourself into this. And so that's been kind of a learning curve. I'm like, oh, fuck.
What about Dori Previn? So
I'm working on a zine about her.
It's probably going to be printed.
Yeah, started it. It's been on and off. My friend Beth is putting it out probably in a couple months. I've been working on it, trying to find a voice to it. Because that was the problem, was that when I do write about other people, it ends up being like a biography.
So be
it. Which is cool, absolutely.
But this is personal for you. It is personal because she went on to this like huge career with Andre Previn and everything, and then like she's from our town.
Right.
It's really about you connecting with that.
Right. She grew up on the street behind my mom's house. So.
What was her address?
She was on Columbus Avenue. So.
Is that the one behind your mother?
Exactly. Well, it runs. It runs parallel. So it's the next street from where my mom's block is. She's like right over there. So literally right around the block. That record is
the one Dori Previn record I got on your recommendations. Great. It's like, it's a strange folk record. It doesn't sound like anything else.
Right.
I was sort of expecting Joni Mitchell and like,
not at all. So dope. Dark.
I had no idea who she was. Marissa turned me on to her too, you know, and she had this.
I'm not a devotee. I don't know all the records, but I know the one is like Kings, the something Kings, and
Mythical
like
Kings and Iguanas.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
You were instantly hooked and fascinated with Dori Previn from the moment
immediately.
This was around the time when you like co-hosted a few shows with me,
right?
Pat,
right.
And
I was in the thick of it.
You were all about Dori Previn, and we never got to. That was the funny thing. We never got to talk about her. Two episodes. Right. We never got to talk about her.
Well, then I think we planned on doing another episode and talking about it, but it never came to fruition.
Yeah, that was the end of the season. We were wrapping up.
And I kind of like put it aside. You know, it was an obsession for a while, and then I kind of put it aside. And then I was like, you know, I really want to do something with it because it's a really interesting story. It's very cool that someone from our town or my town who grew up around the block went on to have such an awesome career and also a fascinating life. Very dark
and a great artist. I think she's a great artist too,
and she was also,
you know, very original,
very original, and I think very ahead of her time.
I think she
came out at the right time,
right? And I think because of, you know, the sort of sexist nature of the way things were back then, that like, you know, Andre Previn got all the headlines while his wife sort of languished in a way,
right?
You know, and Andre Previn is like, you know, wildly, yeah.
Yeah, she co-wrote a lot of songs for, you know, Julie. Valley of the Dolls, Dionne Warwick. She wrote that song. She wrote a lot of great stuff. And then her partnership with Previn, you know, dissipated.
Did she marry him after he was with Mia Farrow?
No, she was friends. He left her for Mia Farrow. He got Mia Farrow pregnant.
Oh,
she
really?
Was actually best. Yeah, so she was best friends with Mia Farrow and kind of started bringing her around. And so Mia Farrow would like hang out with her and Previn, and they started, you know, banging.
Damn, baby.
See, I thought this was after Mia Farrow.
Yeah. So he got her pregnant, and then she had a mental breakdown because she was schizophrenic, but she had a complete mental breakdown after that. And then she kind of came back from it, but she goes through that. She wrote a couple books and she kind of goes through all that in her books, but yeah, it's interesting. And then she also in her book, she was molested by her father in an attic in the house, the one in Columbus Avenue.
Flowers in the attic.
Right. And the similarities, right, between her being molested by her father is a lot. She claims that Mia Farrow stole that story for the Woody Allen molestation story. So it's a very similar situation with the toy trains, and it's very dark. But she claims that Mia Farrow was fucking nuts and stole
her husband.
But she also stole the story of her being molested. And it's the same exact story. Her father brought her to the attic. They looked at toy trains. And the same exact story happened with Mia Farrow's daughter. So it's a really...
Don't even get me started on Mia Farrow.
Don't even get me started. She's, you know, a lot of people really disagree with me on this. So it's kind of it's kind of like a hot take. You know, one of my hot takes is that she's fucking nuts. And yeah, I mean, and it kind of goes back. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, like, throughout my book, a lot of these people that I've interviewed were, like, you know, cameramen and sound people and people who worked on Woody Allen's movies. So, like, I end up with these really wonderful chapters on, you know, Annie Hall and all these other movies, right? And, like, I like, at some point, I'm going to have to, like, deal with them, you know? And I'm going to have to watch that HBO documentary. And I've got, like, all this inside dirt on the way, like, him and Gordon Willis, his DP, would work. And that shit amazes me. Gordon Willis is like one of my heroes. You know, Gordon Willis invented so many different things. He was the DP on Clute and All the President's Men and all these movies. And then, like, he most famously, The Godfather. So he invented a box that we still use today. There's like a big box of lights with like a white cloth around it, right? That hangs in the ceiling to give the impression of light from an attic. So, like, when The Godfather was made, everyone's eyes would look hooded because the light was coming from above, right?
Right.
So, Gordon Willis invented that, and we use it on TV all the time today. I mean, it's like a big, again, that's one of those things that might not make the book because it's only interesting to, like, you know, those of us who are interested. But my point being that, like, I have all these, I'm going to have to deal with the Woody Allen legacy at some point in the edit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like the, I have this conversation all the time with people, you know, separating the artist from the person, whether or not you think, you know, I mean, whatever you feel about Woody Allen, it's the same as Polanski. However you feel about Polanski, you know, he's a monster, but I fucking love his movies, you know, to this day, and still one of my favorite fucking movies. And, you know, you have to, you can't, and that's the problem, I think, a lot. What, you know, today is that a lot of people can't separate the two, so it's easier for them to just cancel that artist out completely than to separate.
Right. You know, the Tenant was a big influence on what we were doing 20 years ago.
Right.
On like My Little Movies. You know,
you
like
two turned me onto that.
Yeah.
That was one that I had not
even
seen.
Even today, there's certain R. Kelly jams. I can't deny the power of those jams. They're beautiful to me.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's like music, any kind of art.
Listen, do you remember 20 years ago, we were very flippant about this conversation in a way that I feel like less flippant about now. I feel like I've become more sensitive to that perspective now than I was 20 years ago because I was younger and like more headstrong. And I feel like now I'm like, I feel like if you're not feeling that and that offends you, that's fine. You know, like,
right.
I don't know how to deal with it in a way.
You know, I get it.
I don't have a rule of thumb. We used to remember like 20 years ago, our rule of thumb was like separate the art from the artist and da, 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 da. And like, I get it if some people can't do that, especially people who've been marginalized by society. I'm not quite sure what the best approach is my point. I'm more sensitive
to
than I had previously been.
I get that. I don't think that the artist should be canceled though, or disregarded.
Well, it never works.
It never works, but it's also, you know, that's fine if you want to do that, but as far as, you know, artists normally aren't really that great of a people, you know, they're ego-driven, they have a lot of fucking skeletons. I mean, I've read so many autobiographies on actors, musicians, artists, And I would say about 90% of them are fucked up. You know,
that's another thing, Bill. That's another thing Friedkin said in that documentary. He's like, everyone should have something unforgivable in their past. Right. And I love that. I love that. It's so true, right? Like, you know, it's what makes us human.
I kind of think that way, as far as for me, at least. You people are free to like and dislike whoever they want, but don't tell me who I can and cannot like or what I can't like.
Everything is so politically motivated now. The whole cancel thing is it's all rooted in just political vengeance.
Wins.
Right.
Scoring and, points right. for your team.
Right. So, exactly.
Know, like rock musicians. It's not just Hollywood. I mean, before Hollywood, it just became very fashionable to go after Hollywood stars in the last 5 years, 6 years, because again, it's politically motivated. But in terms of rock stars, Sinead O'Connor was ruined, and that was 30 years ago. They tried to bring down Elvis the second he went on television. They went after the Beatles. They went after Kiss. They went after Ozzy. They went after the Dixie Chicks, man.
Priest. Judas Priest.
You know, Rock Under Fire, man. I named my podcast after it.
But, well, I grew up in that. Was it PMRC?
Yeah. When we were kids, that was the
thing. We were in the thick of that as, you know, kids. Mm-hmm. So that was like a huge, huge deal, especially listening to metal, you know, metalheads, you know.
Metalheads and hip hop heads. Like when I hear like someone, like I listen to the jams I used to love, right? And you hear someone like Nas casually using like, you know, the F word for gays, right? And like, I feel uncomfortable,
right?
Because I feel like my friends feel uncomfortable. You know what I mean? And even though I love those jams, I still like I feel like a sensitivity towards that. Like now that I didn't, and I think it has to do with getting older, more mature, and you see how people suffered in these marginalized communities. Yeah. You know, so right. I still love those jams, but at the same time, I feel where you're coming from, and it's complicated. Turn it around, Mike.
Turning it around, and we've been talking with Mike Nierenberg and Marissa Baldessaro.
I hope we weren't boring. Were we boring? Marissa, were we boring? In my mind, I think we're the funniest people on earth. And then, like, I'm like, oh, wait a second. We're boring. You know what I mean?
Why are you so serious?
Yeah, because we had some serious moments. I'm sorry, Stick. Right.
You're good.
We had like, I was just saying, we had like two shows. We have enough. We're editing just as much as we recorded.
I'm sorry. I know you must hate editing. It's
like,
so
you
boring.
Should release the.
I don't mind editing. Like, I don't mind if it's like long. Like, I know that there's like a major 15 minute chunk that's going to get axed, and that's okay because I can just let it. And we're live from Brooklyn and live from Marissa's car.
Hey, boss. Yo, boss.
Boss, you want milk? Milk and sugar, boss? No, thank you.
These guys good?